On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich says the U.S. tradition of democratic capitalism has gone badly wrong. A generation of free market adulation, says Reich, has built a kind of capitalism so powerful that it is overwhelming the democracy it is supposed to support. He calls it super capitalism, a capitalism that brings us dirt cheap blue jeans and falling wages, no job security, and a government owned by corporate lobbyists. It's time to choose, says Reich, whether we are consumers first or citizens first. Tough question these days. Up next on Point, Robert Reich and super capitalism. Joining me now from New York is Robert Reich. He served in three presidential administrations with Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, and most recently as Labor Secretary under Bill Clinton. He's a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, an outspoken commentator on issues economic and political, and author of the new book, Super Capitalism, The Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life. Robert Reich, welcome. Great to have you.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. And interested to hear your argument. We know capitalism. What's the difference between capitalism and super capitalism?
Capitalism, old-fashioned capitalism, had to do with, obviously, goods and services and production and all those wonderful things. Super capitalism, which I date from the beginning of the late 70s, increasing escalation through the last three decades, provides consumers with much, much greater choice, a world of choice, literally, and also investors with much, much greater deals, far greater deals. If you look at, the iPods and the antidepressants and the hybrid cars and the flat screen TVs and even the longer lifespans we have, we're getting a lot out of super capitalism. It's for consumers and investors, it's unambiguously good. For us as citizens, in terms of the values that we hold in common, there are some problems. We all know them: widening inequality, unstable jobs, pollution, global warming, the loss of main streets to big box retailers. And the question really that I ask is, why is it that democracy is unable to respond to these, if you will, social costs of supercapitalism? While consumers and investors are getting such terrific deals, we as citizens seem to be less and less effective. And indeed, if you simply look at citizen surveys, there's a big difference over the last 30 years. Most people, when asked how's democracy working 30 years ago in the United States, said, really, very, very well. Government works for most of the people most of the time. More recently, in the last 10 years, the same question asked on surveys, people say, no, it's all run by the special interests. It's not. For me, government is no longer something that I recognize as mine. And I suggest that there's a connection between the rise of supercapitalism, the dominance and success of us as investors and as consumers, and the decline of us in our roles as citizens. And the irony, Tom, and I hope we have time to get to this, the irony is that we're both. I mean, we obviously, most of us are consumers. We're all consumers. Most of us are investors, and most of us are also citizens, but we have lost the ability, the practice of citizenship, as we have been dominated by our consumer and investment sides.
But we're invested in both sides of this equation. You describe a very real tension here. And you look back, Robert Reich, to a time when the capitalism-democracy balance, in your view, was healthier. Sort of 50s through the 70s. Paint a picture of what was going on then that you see as different from what's happening now.
Well, I call it the not-quite-golden age.
Right.
Because I want readers to understand that I know, as they may if they live through it, that that age was not perfect. Women and African Americans were still disenfranchised through most of it. We made some headway. At the beginning, the environment was still quite polluted. We did make headway. We had Joe McCarthy and the problems of anti-communist witch hunts. So it wasn't perfect. But here's what was good about that time. for the first time in the 20th century, in fact, for the first time in American history, Americans were moving together in terms of income and wealth. There was a kind of compression of wages. CEOs didn't make all that much more than average workers. Everybody was more or less together taking advantage of productivity gains. Even if you were in the bottom 20%, you saw your wages and incomes go up. Jobs were much more stable than they'd ever been before. And overall, our main streets were thriving. Our communities were thriving. We called it democratic capitalism, with a small d on democratic. This is not a partisan. This was not a partisan idea. Democratic capitalism, because we thought that capitalism and democracy went hand in glove. Unions were powerful. They were a major force for not only bargaining for better wages for people, but also allowing blue-collar workers to have a say in not only politics, but also the kind of informal political bargaining that went on between big business and labor. We had a very curious thing in our corporations, something called corporate statesmen. Now, we don't hear much about them, but they were CEOs who took a national role in the national debates, often, interestingly, at the not necessarily in the interest of their own companies. They, for example, we had CEOs who were very active in developing the Marshall Plan and even increasing taxes to pay for a lot of things that needed to happen.
The sort of wise men, civic-minded corporate graybeards who do that. You say that cannot happen anymore because the global winds of competition are so severe that there's no room for a CEO to play that kind of role.
Those CEO statesmen are gone. Labor unions are now, instead of a third of the workforce, down to fewer than 8% of the private sector workforce. All of the systems we had in place to indirectly express the common good during that not quite golden age have almost disappeared, Tom. And in their place, we have just the super capitalism, again, terrific for us as consumers and for our 401k plans, notwithstanding the past turbulence in the markets, still. We're doing wonderfully well compared to what we were doing 30 years ago. But as citizens, we're sort of we're afloat. We don't know how to express ourselves. We are concerned. Most of us, most of the survey shows that most people are concerned about global warming and widening inequality and stagnant wage growth. And, you know, the Census Bureau came out last week and said that if you compare wages this year to 2000 – actually, it was last year, technically, to 2000. The only people who are doing better than they did in the year 2000 are people in the top 5%. Everybody else is working harder and not doing better. And that's been more or less the case since the late 70s. This is not just the 2000s. This has been a very long-term problem. But why can we not fix our healthcare system or fix our wages or provide for all of the things we need, better education? Why can't we tackle global warming? Why is it so difficult? Because our politics has been polluted by super capitalism.
It sounds so like such a simple, straightforward equation, but, I mean, the American democracy has lived, hand in glove with capitalism for a very long time. There have been times when it was prettier and times when it was less pretty. But Americans historically have been pretty comfortable with this relationship. I mean, there's been times when they pushed back hard after the Depression. But, I mean, what is it about American attitudes that you think let capitalism, in your view, get so far out of its box?
Well, here's what makes me optimistic, Tom. You're right. We have pushed back as a population, as American citizens. We pushed back at the first part of the 20th century after inequalities got very, very wide, when you had small children working in factories, when people were working, blue-collar workers, 60, 70 hours. We had sweatshops. We had all sorts of problems in our country, and we pushed back.
But now we've got all kinds of goodies, as you say. Yes, there's stagnant wages and job insecurity, but as you say, super capitalism has produced a lot of goodies as well. Do you see Americans pushing back this time?
Ah, well, I was trying to say I'm optimistic because, you know, you look at our history and we do have these periods of pushback. But you put your finger on it. Right now, we do have so many goodies from supercapitalism in terms of consumers and investors. Are we willing to pay the price? There are trade-offs here. I mean, if we want to combat global warming, we're going to have to pay for it, maybe a carbon tax. Are we willing to give up some of those goodies or get gas that's more expensive? Are we willing, if we want to have a more equal workforce, are we willing to invest as much as needs to be invested in education? Are we willing to have a progressive, more progressive income tax? Are we willing to pay the price? I mean, if we don't like Walmart, instead of picking on Walmart for its low wages, if Walmart were to raise its wages, or if we were going to have a law requiring all big box retailers to pay more for their employees, well, under super capitalism, that means that we are going to have to pay more for the goods and services we get out of big box retailers, because they're going to have to pass on those wage increases to somebody, and consumers are basically who they pass the wage increases on to. Are we willing to make that sacrifice? That's the big question.
We're talking this hour with former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, now at the University of California, Berkeley, a professor of public policy there. You may have heard him on Marketplace. He also contributes to the American Prospect. Robert Reich is with us. His new book is Super Capitalism, The Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life. He's arguing that capitalism is outstripped, maybe overwhelmed, democracy in this country. You quote Milton Friedman right at the beginning of the book, along with John Kenneth Galbraith, I should say. But you quote him saying, the kind of economic organization that provides economic freedom directly, namely competitive capitalism, also promotes political freedom because it separates economic power from political power and in this way enables the one to offset the other. That's been a powerful idea for a long time. Why isn't it working? I guess you're saying it's not.
Well, I think that if you look at Milton Friedman's writings more specifically, that was his most famous notion about the politics of freedom went with capitalism. One followed the other inevitably. But a closer reading suggests that he didn't really believe that. That he believed that that free markets were a necessary precondition for political freedom, but not a sufficient condition for political freedom, Tom. You need something else. You need a vibrant democracy. And I quote John Kenneth Galbraith because he was sort of my mentor and hero. He talked a lot about why things were as they were in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in terms of politics and economics, why they worked as well as they did, came up with this theory of countervailing power. Mm-hmm. You know, we had big corporations and we had big labor unions. We had big manufacturers, and then we had big retailers. The things seemed to balance off each other. That's no longer the case. And as I suggested before, we now have corporations and supercapitalism that has invaded politics and democracy, not because corporations are bad, but because corporations have to be much more competitive than ever. And it's been kind of an arms race. You know, when I was in Washington, and I've been in Washington at different intervals.
Quite a bit.
Since the 1970s. But every time I come back, I am shocked at how much more powerful the corporate lobbies are. And I am also aware that most of what they are doing is not lobbying necessarily directly against the public interest. They're lobbying against each other. You know, it's the proprietary drug manufacturers against the generic drug manufacturers. It's Google against Microsoft. It's, you know, most of what goes on in Washington and why it's so noisy, why there are now 33,000 lobbyists as opposed to about 7,000 when I first went to Washington, is because most of them are protecting and advancing the competitive positions of their own industries or own companies. But it's so loud, all of that cacophony of lobbyists and money, that the public and the citizen in us is completely drowned out.
You know, Robert Reich, it's obvious looking around the world now that democracy and capitalism do not necessarily go hand in hand. Just look at China. Plenty of capitalism there, very little democracy. How serious is the threat to American democracy that you're describing here? How big a deal is this in your mind? Give us some sense of scale. I mean, we see in China what can happen in one direction. Are you saying democracy's in that much trouble?
No, I don't think we're heading toward a kind of authoritarian capitalism, Tom. But if we're not careful, we are going to lose our democracy. I think we're already in danger of the public's voice not being heard, maybe on certain highly visible controversial issues like Iraq or the so-called cultural wars. But on the day-to-day business of Washington, no, you can almost not hear. And again, I speak from experience. You don't hear the public anymore. That's the serious and I think profound danger we face. If we start thinking of ourselves as consumers and as investors first, and as citizens second or third, if we don't practice citizenship. And I know that sounds like a kind of airy-fairy idea to you, but it really isn't. I mean, the practice of citizenship is as important as the practice of being consumers and investors.
For the record, that does not sound airy-fairy to me, Robert Reich.
Well, good. I'm glad because, you know, I've been talking to people about this for years. I've been worrying about it for years. I finally put it down in a book. But the reaction I often get from people is, yes, that sounds nice, the practice of citizenship, but we don't know what it means.
But there are a lot of challenges to it out there right now. We can see that. And, of course, the market itself can present real challenges. I want to look at those, think about what does the competition from China mean? You know, can we go back to what you call that almost golden age, or does it have to be something quite different? And if you don't mind, I'd also like to get a little perspective from the free market crowd in here just to see how this debate is likely to unfold as you raise it up. Robert Reich in New York, please stand by for just a moment. I want to bring in, joining us today, Marvin Zonis. He's a political economist, professor emeritus at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business, advocate for free trade, expert on emerging economies. He joins us from vacation in Italy. Lucky Professor Zonis. Marvin Zonis, thanks very much for being with us.
Great pleasure, Tom. Hi, Professor Reich.
Hi, Professor Zonis. Nice to talk with you.
You hear Robert Reich's argument that capitalism has become so potent and the interests of the corporations that represent it, so highly funded and loud in Washington that citizens and democracy is kind of getting drowned out. What do you think of that equation as a free market guy, Marvin Zonis?
I share that view, as a matter of fact, Tom, and it is the solution to the problems the professor has elucidated is not to eliminate or limit capitalism, as he has pointed out, but to increase the other side of the equation, the citizenship side of the equation. And there's so much evidence around about the role of corporations not, as he has said, trying to win advantage against their own competitors. There's a wonderful book which I would recommend to the readers in addition to Professor Reich's new book. Two of my colleagues at the business school, Raghuram Rajan, who's just stepped down as director of research at the IMF, and Luigi Zingales, and the two of them, Rajan and Zingales, have written a book called Saving Capitalism from the Capitalists. And what they argue is that the great attack on capitalism is not coming anymore from the socialists. It comes from individual companies attacking other companies to try to get competitive advantage. And in that project, we all lose out in the end as consumers and investors.
But fascinating that you share the core concern. Robert Reich, then, you hear that. What about it? Marvin Zonis says, then, okay, don't pound down capitalism, but build up citizenship. Why not go at it that way, Robert Reich?
Well, I am quite delighted that Professor Zonis and the University of Chicago Business School crowd, if I may be so bold as to provide that typology for all of you, I mean, that you agree. I mean, I don't want in any way to sacrifice capitalism. I want to enrich democracy. I don't think they are necessarily at odds. I want to get the capitalists out of democracy. I don't want businesses and business lobbies to be as dominant in Washington. I don't want this arms race that is going on in Washington between companies and industries trying to get more and more subsidies, trying to get more and more advantage for themselves. I think it is anti-capitalist. And the fact that Professor Zonis agrees with me is absolutely wonderful. The question is, now that we have agreement along the ideological spectrum, how do we What do we do about it? I have some ideas for what we do about it, but I'd be very interested in hearing Professor Zonis's ideas.
Well, I wonder, first of all, you say, you know, you don't want to sacrifice capitalism, but you do talk in your book, Supercapitalism, about a return to more regulation. Now, for a long time, we've been told that that was a kind of burden on capitalism, you know, that left us all worse off.
Well, for example, Tom, I am a proponent of a carbon tax. The only way we are going to make any headway against global warming, against overly dependent, too much dependence on Middle Eastern oil, is if we recognize the social costs that are engaged or involved in capitalism, and one of those social costs has to do with dependence on Middle Eastern oil and pollution, and a carbon tax. Well, I don't call it regulation; I just call it correcting the market, and I don't know that. Professor Zonis would be opposed to that, but it does mean that people have to pay more. And this is the problem. There are trade-offs. We can't be quite as bold or as flamboyant as we are as consumers and investors if we want to genuinely tackle the social problems that we have that emerge from our extraordinarily successful capitalism.
Marvin Zonis, do you agree that there's some trimming of the sails required here on the capitalism front to get democracy back in shipshape?
Well, let me go back to the book which the professor has already mentioned, which is Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman. What's amazing, a close reading of that book shows you how many regulations, how many taxes he is in fact in favor of, because what we know is that without serious governmental regulation, you don't end up with capitalists. And the best example of that I can give you is the Russian example after the collapse of communism. The Boris Yeltsin years were not capitalist years. They were banditry because the state wasn't powerful enough to regulate the economy. So, yes, that's number one. Number two, I would say, is if we could awake the citizenry to the real costs of energy in this country, they would be in favor of a carbon tax. Let me just give you an example. The reality is that the price of gasoline at the pump doesn't reflect the real cost to us as a nation. The real cost must include hundreds of billions of dollars of money spent on the military in the Persian Gulf to keep the oil flowing. You ought to translate that back into the price of gasoline at the pump.
And you're the free market guy looking at it that way. Marvin Zonis, please stand by for a moment. Robert Reich, lots of listeners want to join us, and I want to begin to bring them in. Jeff is calling from Bloomfield, Connecticut. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, hi, Tom. Great
hi.
Show.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, great debate. I agree with Professor Reich's idea that democracy is being compromised. However, I think hypercapitalism might be a bit inarticulate term. I think that the favor of investment income over earned income has been a fundamental problem in the economy that's really started to cut the middle class out. Remember, we've had Republican administrations who absolutely said that government was the problem, and you have people like Grover Norquist who said he wants to drown government in the bathtub. Couple that with the absolute attack on labor since Joe McCarthy came around, where you have a Chamber of Commerce that says we want a union-free environment, and now Professor Rice said that the percentage of people that are unionized in the private sector is under 8%, and it's not easy. It's not too hard to see what's happened.
But Jeff, let me ask you, Jeff. You know, Americans are not rioting in the streets; they're shopping at Walmart.
I was going to say another point is the passivity of the American populace. I've got to acknowledge my bias. I was a union steward at my place of work for about 20 years and an activist for a long period of time. And you can't get some people off their fat rear end. And maybe at the point of a gun you can. But you can't get people to educate themselves and vote in their interest. I mean, you get, you know, I worked with people who were great union people very often, who voted for candidates because they favored gun they favored having people guns. It was a one-trick pony issue. Or you had somebody who was an evangelical Christian who voted for somebody because they believed in God.
So there's a concern about whether or not Americans will even stand up on this front. Robert Reich, how about that? Are you confident that if you give Americans a choice of, you know, consumer goodies or citizenship, they'll tilt towards citizenship?
Well, let's put it this way, Tom. I'm not 100% confident. I think that it's very important to get our thinking straight about these issues. I think that if Americans understood how imperiled our democracy is and also understood that corporations are not people, that issues such as corporate social responsibility, which we really haven't talked about yet in this show, are maybe helpful, but they really are distractions often from the hard work of making our democracy work. I mean, Jeff talks about, and by the way, Jeff, it's not hypercapitalism, it's supercapitalism, and I try to avoid the term hypercapitalism because I don't want to load it in one direction or the other. The name of the book is Supercapitalism. But Jeff, you talk about the bias toward investment income over earned income, you're absolutely right. I think that has put a huge burden on average Americans and even made the rich richer. You also talk about the right wing's attack on government. And as Professor Zonis observed and agrees with me, without government, you can't have capitalism. And I think Milton Friedman, as Professor Zonis pointed out, also agreed with that. You point out, Jeff, the attack on labor, and that has been undoubtedly an attack. But as I point out in my book, part of that has been almost a natural consequence of globalization of markets, of consumers getting better and better and better deals, of choosing non-unionized goods sometimes when they are cheaper than unionized goods because, after all, consumers would like to get the best deal and don't, in their heart of hearts, maybe care as much about unionization as you, Jeff, or I care about. So it's not going to be, Tom, back to your question, is it going to be a cakewalk? No, it's going to be hard to rekindle the practice of citizenship and also get our politicians to be forthright about the costs of doing that to our consumers and investors in our heads. But I think it's the only way to go. This is such a huge central problem and challenge for us that I don't see any option.
Marvin Zonis, I know we've just got you for another minute there. After all, you're on vacation and you've earned it. Do you agree with Robert Reich? You're the Chicago school. So do you agree that U.S. democracy is imperiled by some capitalist excess? It's a big statement.
Well, I don't think we have a capitalist excess. I think what we have is a government which has abandoned its responsibilities to American citizens, not necessarily to bring capitalism under greater control, but to bring the public goods to citizens, for example, such as education. And the idea that if we should eliminate government, everything would be great in this country is total madness. And the reality is, if you look, what's happened is we haven't eliminated government in the least. We've just moved the pieces around.
Robin Zonis, thanks very much for being with us.
Great pleasure, Tom.
Let's take a call from East Lansing, Michigan. Patrick, you're on the air with Robert Reich.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Professor Reich, you're one of my heroes. I had you as a teacher at the Kennedy School and also John Kenneth Galbraith, and I just want to ask how your ideas might explain some things that have happened recently. In Michigan today, the report is that the vast majority of new jobs put people in poverty, and in all of our cities in Michigan, we have more than one in third in poverty. But I want to ask you about where my rest of my family is in California, where they tried to do something about it, and the Democratic state legislature passed a law dealing with retail workers and fast food workers, large employers only, and mandated that they either provide health care or pay a fee to cover their share of the Medicaid costs of their workers.
Yeah.
And then these very industries put together a slush fund and spent millions and got a referendum passed by about half a percentage of the popular vote to strip it all away and take it away. And the other program they tried was to get the statewide voters to pass a law that provided paid preschool, which we have in Canada and much of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
To my way of thinking, letting people have health care who are struggling on welfare or just without it in a job and giving their children a way to get an education early would be two top priorities, and yet big corporate money, uncontrolled, was able to overwhelm even voters, and I just wonder what the lessons of that are.
Robert Reich.
Well, Patrick, it's good to hear from you again, and I won't reveal that you got an A-minus in the course, because that would be a violation of your privacy. No, you were a great student, and I'm to the two points you raise, or the two examples you raise, Patrick, the California, both from my new home state, mandating health care and then business groups basically through a referendum or initiative getting rid of that, and the same thing with paid preschool, do illustrate my point. You know, there's a big movement these days for corporate social responsibility. And I understand that movement to try to get individual corporations to behave better. But if corporate social responsibility means anything, to me, it means staying out of politics, not corrupting the democratic political process. And the examples you give are prime examples of big corporations doing exactly that, being irresponsible, maybe acting in the interests of their shareholders. I think that's what they thought they were doing. But they're not even doing that, because a lot of the shareholders, as citizens, probably did want health care, and they also did want paid preschool. But they couldn't exercise the citizenship part of their brains because the corporations were basically being so irresponsible as to enter politics. If I could just add one further thought, Patrick, one of the things I present in the book, an idea, is what I call a Stockholder Protection Act, something analogous to what's called payroll or Paycheck Protection Acts that are now in vogue in a lot of states. Those Paycheck Protection Acts basically say to a union, you can't do any political organizing, you can't lobby with your members' dues, unless you get their permission. Well, why not the same thing on the corporate side? You can't use your shareholders' money to do political things, such as, Patrick, the two fairly nefarious corporate lobbying attempts and successful attempts that you pointed to. You can't do that unless you get your shareholders' permission. And if any shareholder says no, because his or her citizen in his or her head said, no, that's not, I don't want to do that, then you've got to give that pro rata share of your political money back to that citizen.
So put corporations under similar constraints to unions when it comes to lobbying the public.
Absolutely, just for exactly the reasons that Patrick gave us.
You would go further. You would go all the way back to, what, the late 19th century, when corporations were given the status of persons by the Supreme Court. You would strip that away. That's a radical change.
Well, Tom, I would. I don't think corporations are people. They're contracts. They're pieces of paper. We've got it in our heads. I call it the anthropomorphic fallacy, that the corporations really do have rights. They have First Amendment rights. They have the rights to be involved in politics because they are people. They are not people. And I say in the book, let's acknowledge that. Let's say corporations are not people. They shouldn't even be taxed, because we've got into this notion that, you can't be taxed without representation. Well, corporations really should not be taxed. Let's abolish the corporate income tax, because, after all, it's not corporations who pay. It's people who pay. And that corporation, even that corporate income tax, is ultimately paid by people. It's passed on to individuals. Let's not do anything that further misleads us into thinking that corporations are people.
But you've got 120 years of Supreme Court precedent saying they are.
Oh, but Supreme Court precedents, Tom, believe me, they are overturned all the time. Look at the current court, if you want to think about Supreme Court precedents being overturned. No, if we get our thinking straight, that straight thinking about corporations not being people will certainly influence future Supreme Courts, and it will influence certainly future legislators.
I wonder how much freedom we have just to think of a new framework and implement kinds of controls and regulations in a global economy. But let's come to that after a call from another Patrick in Columbia, South Carolina. Carolina Patrick, you're on the air, sir.
Hi. I'm listening to your conversation. I think it's an important one. I think I go even farther than what these gentlemen were just talking about and consider clean elections, free of corporate money, a public good, and, you know, do all funding through the government, through our tax dollars. And, you know, that's the sure way to free the electoral system from private interests. And in addition to that, I'd just like to say that, you know, I agree that philosophically this is a role of government looking forward, and I think that a vehicle for achieving, you know, the kind of frameworks we need to solve problems like global energy, climate change, terrorism, will require, you know, an improvement in voter efficacy. And
won't the markets take care of that, Patrick? I mean, that's what we've been told for a long time.
Well, I don't think that markets will necessarily create political outcomes that we deem, you know, prudent or wise. I think that, you know, globalization should be used to maximize the size of the pie, so to speak, and then prudent public policies should be used to redistribute that pie, you know, to reduce inequality and to increase the provision of public goods, whether it's education, healthcare, transportation, security.
Patrick, that's great. Robert Reich, can you do that? If you back off of super capitalism, can you still maximize the pie, maximize, you know, the growth of the economy that's been so supportive or was so supportive for a long time to democracy and thought to be kind of hand in glove? Or do you have to accept some diminished economic performance overall here to bring in the constraints and buffers that you're describing?
Look, Tom, there are some trade-offs between a rapidly growing economy and social equity, social justice, cleaning up the environment, and so on. I don't think we should pretend that there aren't any, but we can't even address those trade-offs unless we have a vibrant democracy capable of addressing them. Patrick's notion of public financing is absolutely right. Right now we have major candidates for the presidency, all of whom have rejected public financing in the primaries, and the reason they've rejected is there's not enough money in the kitty for public financing. We've got to, if we're serious about the practice of citizenship, we've got to make sure that public financing is a reality.
I don't understand quite, though, how this works in a globalized economy. I mean, China's not going away. China's pumping out low-cost goods and increasingly services, India as well. That's a fact. Does this require trade barriers to get the job security and higher wages you're talking about? Can we, you know, is it an opt-out of the global economy scenario that you're painting to make room for that citizenship to regrow?
No, I don't think so, Tom. I do believe the trade treaties ought to have labor amendments, labor features, so that, for example, if you're dealing with a developing nation, their minimum wage ought to be half their median wage. As they grow, as they become richer, they ought to be, therefore, if their minimum wage is half their median wage, they would be paying their people more and more, and gradually those people would become middle class and capable of importing our goods.
But why would
services.
China listen to that argument for a second? I mean, why would China pay any attention to that call from the United States of America?
Well, China is a special case. China needs us as much as we need them.
Really? We're so in debt to them, we don't make the things that they make? You know, everything we touch is made in China. We don't need them?
Well, as we're witnessing right now between debtors and creditors here in the United States, if you are a big enough creditor and a big enough debtor, you are in a mutual dance where you really are dependent on one another.
But if you
China
start to tell Beijing how to set its wages, who's going to cry first?
No. Tom, I don't think we can do quite that. Mm. But never underestimate the power of the commercial forces in the United States. Look what we did just by putting pressure on one bank with regard to getting North Korea to the bargaining table. Look at what we've done with regard to Burma. The United States is the largest market in the world. Everybody wants into our market. We have enormous power because of that market to get other nations to play in ways that we want them to play. Not in every instance. Obviously, you're right. China has huge clout as well. We are indebted to China. Over $1 billion a day we're borrowing from China. But nevertheless, do not underestimate the power that the United States has in the world simply because everybody wants to get into our market and sell goods here in the United States. We can have an influence. We can change the global rules of the game to some extent. And even when we can't, we can, as citizens, say, look, we want health care. We want better wages. Major corporations doing business here are going to have to play by the rules that we impose on them. The biggest challenge for us, Tom, is that we as citizens have got to understand that we as consumers may have to pay a little bit more for the goods and services we want if these public goods are going to really be available to us.
That means a diminished standard of living at the consumer level, the consumption level.
At the consumption level and as the at the investor level. Consumers and investors over the last 30 years have done wonderfully well. And it's not just the iPods and the newfangled stuff. I mean, look at what's happened to the cost of color televisions, of microwave ovens, everything has gone down in terms of it being more efficiently produced. That's been a help to the poor. A lot of Americans now fill their houses with stuff, and that's fine. But the practice of citizenship, the public goods that we need in terms of cleaner air and public education, a good public education, and also a little bit more security in terms of our jobs and higher investment in people. We are capable as a nation of getting them. We're rich enough to get them. I mean, this is the richest nation in history. But our practice of citizenship has been so corroded over the last 30 years that we don't even know that we are capable of getting this. And our political leaders are so indebted to corporations and to lobbyists and to lobbying money that they're not telling us, they're not reminding us of what we can get as citizens.
Let me take a couple calls very quickly. Mary in Houston, Texas. You're on the air, Mary.
Hello, Tom. My comment is about this need to increase citizenship, and an alternate way to do that, using a carrot instead of a stick, is to say to corporations, we will reduce your income tax. Don't take away the income tax, but use it through our legislature, who's supposed to work for us, and say, if you do the right thing and you employ Americans and you give health care to your citizens' employees, then we will reduce your taxes. And also for individuals, if you do the right thing, if you buy your own health care, we will reduce your tax.
So use taxes as leverage. Let us hold that and get one more call from Groton, Connecticut. Don, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
All right. What do you think, Don?
I think that government is the villain here, and I'd much, much rather have the money that's been taken from me by Social Security in my possession in the form of a stock portfolio that I owned, rather than taken from me and given to today's retirees.
So you're saying no thanks to Robert Reich's prescription?
No property rights and Social Security. More than that, it's not big business or corporations that have ruined our elections with ballot access laws, which keep out smaller parties.
Don, our time is short. Robert Reich, 2 points there. Mary says use taxation as a lever to get the kind of behavior you want from corporations. Don makes the big criticism. You know, government is the problem, and this has been sort of the reigning thesis for quite a while now. Get it out. Let the market work.
Well, to Mary, let me say, absolutely. Let's use whatever vehicles, whatever levers we have to get corporations to do what we want as citizens, not just give us good deals as consumers and investors. To Don, I say, Don, I've heard that over and over and over again, the choice is government versus free market. That's not really the choice. As our guest, Professor Zonis from, of all places, the Chicago Business School, was saying before, Milton Friedman also understood, without government, there can't be a market. Without a market, you can't have capitalism. The question is, how do we create the conditions under which the market actually works for us? How do we make sure that our democracy is not corrupted by business, by capitalism? How do we keep money out? And that's what I wrote the book about. That's why I wrote the book, to get us out of these old ideological debates and reframe the issues.
We've got a new presidential election coming up. On the Democratic side, your home base, is anyone carrying your torch? Who are you behind, Robert Reich?
Well, I'm not really behind anybody right now. I If a candidate has, as they have, they've asked for my views and some policy papers, I give them like a public utility. Even a Republican, there hasn't been a Republican candidate who's asked me, but if they did, I'd tell them what I believed. But look, I'm disappointed the Democrats are still taking a lot of money, not necessarily all of them from lobbyists, but from the usual sources. And they're not saying enough about cleaning up politics. I hope they say more. There's still time, but that is the number one issue. Tom, if we can't do that, we can't do anything else.
We hear it, and we're out of time. Robert Reich's new book is Super Capitalism. This is On Point.